Welcome to another episode of the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, the storytelling show that features The Clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to be told, and where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors. A clearing, a tree, a juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So yes, welcome to the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin. Get in with a seamless count of four so I don't have to edit this later. Welcome, welcome, welcome. That's three already, so hang the expense. Four welcomes to Dan Sue, who has been passed the golden baton, I'm very delighted to say, by the wonderful, gifted performance poet Toby Thompson, who's been here before. And Toby has credited Dan as being a really significant mentor in his life. So it's my great, great pleasure to welcome Dan Sue, who is from Lyrics Organics, which he can tell us all about shortly. On your Bish Bash Bosh profile, you're a creative director, educator, event producer and poet. You're also a DJ and a dad, liking the alliteration there. And yes, welcome. It's really a joy to see you here in The Clearing.
Thank you for having me, Chris. I've been very much looking forward to this, and given the golden baton has been passed to me by a very dear friend, I'm honoured to be here. Thank you.
And if I may, if I could just blow a really happy bit of smoke at you, would you object to me just reading a little bit of what Toby said in positioning why it's lovely to talk to you?
Please do.
Dan has been providing me with opportunities to work and grow and believe in myself as an artist since I was a teenager. Many of my first ever gigs in London were programmed by him. As I know, I'm only one of countless people whose lives he's deeply impacted for the better. Your stage at Glastonbury, which is the Rum Shack, is legendary. And he talks about your son as rather beautifully complimentary. He says your son is a walking embodiment of the term beatific.
Wow.
Wow. And
that is an amazing happy smoke. I mean, it's funny listening to Kate Cross's interview, and she said that she loves sentences. She loves amazing sentences. And so it's no mistake that she picked Toby, because Toby is surely the most beautiful wordsmith and sentence maker I know. And so the fact that he managed to slide in what's the word again?
Beatific.
Beatific into the sentence about myself and my son. I'm very grateful. And it's really beautiful. I've known Toby, since he did a show with Akala's Hip Hop Shakespeare Company, and we were collaborating with Akala. I think it was like 2010. Toby was about 16 at the time, and it was just one of those moments that I get quite regularly, which is beautiful in my line of work, where I just am awestruck by a person and particularly their performance. And I feel very lucky in the line of work that I do, is that I get to kind of keep them, and Toby was very much like, he's in my sights now. I'm never going to let him go.
And
to this day, we're still very, very good friends. And he's a tremendous artist as well.
Wonderful. So he was extremely welcome, as indeed are you. And this idea of passing the golden baton in order to keep the thread going is what's exciting about that construct, actually. So I wouldn't have met you if it wasn't for him, and I'm delighted at both. So yes, if somebody doesn't have a frame of reference, and I'm going to ask you a deliberately clunky question just to get us on the open road. If somebody doesn't have a frame of reference, which we've had very deliciously about you, and they bump into you, know that you look and sound interesting, and they ask you, what do you do? What's your favourite way of answering or avoiding that question, Dan?
My favourite way is a convoluted version, which is I'm an educator and an event producer and creative director. I guess I'm a bit of a jack of all trades, which is slightly self-deprecating. But I find that my journey has been very much about dipping into communities and dipping into cultures. Mm-hmm. And I say dipping in like I'm just a tourist. Actually, I fully immerse myself in those spaces. But I also, and I'll explain a little bit more why later, kind of move in between different circles as well. So Yeah, it's hard for me to pin down, but I say essentially I'm an educator, facilitator. I put on gigs from Glastonbury Festival to small open mic gigs, and I make space is probably my tagline.
I like that as a sort of conduit and enabler and a mentor to many. And am I right in assuming you were one of the first people to give Ed Sheeran his first pop? Is it and Kate Tempest as well?
Yeah, so Ed Sheeran, when he first came down to London when he was about 15, 16, we were putting on a lot of shows around Kentish Town, Camden, with a friend of mine called Rada. And that was kind of one of my entry points into promoting live music. And myself and Ed became very good friends. Indeed, Lyrics Organics is very much founded on the intersection between spoken word, folk music and rap. Mm-hmm. An early Ed Sheeran, or indeed today's Ed Sheeran, is still very much in that kind of intersection of lyricism and acoustic music. And so Lyrics Organics, alongside other artists, people like Disraeli as well, are people who have really inspired and influenced what Lyrics Organics would become. K-Tempest, we can take a bit less kind of influence in. Our first working with K was when we programmed them for the Rumshack at Glastonbury Festival. It was their first big music show on their first album. And it was an incredible show, also full of gremlins, but it was legendary nonetheless. And then we worked together for a few years. She invited Lyrics Organics to perform at Brighton Festival when they were the guest curator. We have been very lucky to fall into circles with people who have gone on to do great things.
Wonderful. And enabled and launched by you. I love the expression, full of gremlins, but legendary nevertheless. What a great... You're a great wordsmith yourself. Do you rap too? Because I know that you encourage a lot of rap music and you've influenced many career paths in that way.
Yeah, as a hobbyist, I've rapped. Like, lyricism and rap and hip-hop culture have been part of me since I was probably about 12, 13. I'm now in my 40s, so that's 3-4 decades worth of just lyrics. Anyone who spent that amount of time would have written their own bars and performed. I started Lyrics Organics partly to surround myself with spoken word artists and rappers who I really admired, to get influence and inspiration that way. I do perform spoken word on occasion. I used to be a drum and bass MC. Again, I'll tell you more about that later. Lyrics, rap, poetry is really important to me. It's like a second skin.
Lovely. Delicious. That's a great segue then to getting us on the open road. It's my absolute joy to curate you through the journey and the construct of the Good Listening To show. It's going to be a clearing a tree. You've been kind enough to, in a moment, to tell me what your clearing is. We're going to shake your tree to see which storytelling apples fall out. I even got a comedy prop apple. How do you like these apples? And then we're going to crunch along the apples of your answers to 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 5 minutes to have thought about 4 things that have shaped you, 3 things that inspire you, 2 things that never fail to grab your attention. That's where the random squirrel will come in. There's also cake, a couple of squirrels, as I mentioned, a golden baton and a cake and some Shakespeare. It's all to play for.
Excellent. Can't wait.
So what is, where is a clearing for you, Dan Su, event promoter extraordinaire?
Slight struggle answering this because my instinct answer is in a club, like in a nightclub, in a dark corner, with the focal point being the DJ. I feel really at peace there, either in a nightclub listening to kind of bass music or in a live music gig. I just have this kind of moment of serenity where all of my best ideas come, and I know it's quite counterintuitive. However, I think for this, what I'm going to do is a little bit more traditional, which is when I go to find peace, because I don't know when I go to a gig whether it's actually going to be peaceful, you know, because it's also a place of work in many cases. So actually, when I try and find a level of peace, it's locally. I live in Southeast London. I live right around the corner from Sydenham Hill, Dulwich Woods, which is a beautiful ancient woodland, the last part that used to there used to be the Great North Wood, which would stretch from Deptford near Greenwich all the way towards Streatham. And there would be a coppice there, and they'll use it for fuel. And then gradually it receded. And the last part of these woods is Dulwich Wood / Sydenham Hill Woods. And it's magical, it's peaceful, it's got history. And I just have a very profound connection with trees particularly. And I think it's partly because I grew up in London, and so I forgive the pun, I pine for green and nature, because I don't see very much of it. It's quite an alien concept for my London being to be surrounded by trees. And I'm lucky when I look out the back of my balcony at the moment, I have allotments. When I look out the front, I see treetops. So it feels like we're a little bit of a tree house. And so, yeah, for me, my clearing would be Sydenham Hill Woods, or possibly Wales for similar reasons.
Lovely positioning. And rather excitingly, no one has yet said in the darkness of a nightclub as the one of the inceptions of their clearing. So I'm excited by both, but I take on board the Dulwich / Sydenham Woods. There we are, which is a perfect segue again. Thank you for bringing in a tree to shake your tree to see which storytelling apples fall out. So this is time to chunter on your apples, crunch along to four things that have shaped you, Dan, three things that inspire you, two things that never fail to grab your attention, la, la, la. You can shake them as you see fit. So how would you like to interpret that part of the exercise?
Okay, so let's go with the four things that shape me. I guess the most obvious thing is being British Chinese, and it's only something I've really realised what that means in the last few years, if I'm honest. So I was born in Edgware. My mum's from Singapore. My dad was from Hong Kong. They moved over in the 70s. My dad grew up in Nigeria, funnily enough. And Edgware is a very Jewish an immigrant community in the 80s when I was growing up there. It was very Jewish. I was surrounded by a Reform synagogue and I can't remember what the other type of synagogue was, but different kind of parts of the Jewish faith. And so I'd be sitting on a park bench at like Friday, Saturday, you know, smoking stuff that I probably shouldn't be. there'll be people on the Sabbath kind of walking past me. And that was a weird kind of contrast, and it in some ways it epitomizes this idea of me growing up in a space where I'm basically the only person who ever looks like me in my surrounding radius, and that could be whether I'm in the classroom at school, it could be whether I'm in a boardroom running a meeting, or if I'm leading workshops, or even DJing at a festival. Basically, and I've only realized this recently, I'm the only one who looks like me, generally. And so this has had a profound effect on what has shaped me, because I tend to move into cultures really feel them and work with them and be part of those communities, but also have that kind of independence to be able to move between them. So as an example, when I was at school, you know, there'll be the Sikh and the Hindu and the Muslim kids in one corner, there'll be the Jewish kids in another, and the Greek and Cypriots in another, and I was good friends with all of them, and I'd just kind of rotate between them. And one group would be like, why are you going to that group? Because they just didn't hang out, and I was the one who kind of could. And so I've always navigated life in a way which is about being authentic in different spaces.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
That's so eloquently put, by the way. It's the idea of being a really wonderful, an outlier, but an inlier, because you're able to move seamlessly between all aspects.
Precisely. Yeah, exactly that. Being an outlier and an inlier. But this is really interesting because as we speak, times are changing very fast. You know, the government's predicted that there's about 300,000 immigrants from Hong Kong due on the BNO passports because of everything that's happening in China, effectively seeking asylum. There's a huge amount of influx of Chinese and East Asian immigrants at the moment for all kinds of reasons, the world economy, the job market, you know, standard of life, the relative cost of living for people from that part of the world. And so actually, with all of that said, this kind of 40-year-old kind of context, it's changing quite rapidly at the moment. I'm no longer the only person in the room. And that in itself is disconcerting for me.
Okay.
It's kind of upsetting what I've known of myself. So I'm kind of in this...
And if I may, is your cultural mix, is your partner Chinese by descent? And therefore, what is your son?
Good question. Yeah, no. So my partner is British. So she was born in Kent. So our child is mixed race, which is really interesting. If I'm honest, as a dad, I haven't fully processed what that means.
Yes.
Because
that's lovely because you've only just worked it out for yourself is what you're saying.
Yeah. And also because this has been controversial at points, but I've because of the virtue of my skin tone and the way that I work with other people, I've never seen race as necessarily the first kind of impression or barrier that other people see, because it's something that I've overcome since I was basically 2 or 3 years old, when I would have to come into nursery and no one could pronounce my name, my surname, Sue. So I was told by my parents to tell everyone, your name is Daniel TSU. So I thought my surname was TSU. It was only until I went into school that I realised that my surname was actually Sue. And so, yeah.
You're in good company there. That's a bit T.S. Eliot, a bit T.S.U.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, I'm just feeling it out at the moment. And it's interesting because having a mixed heritage child is a whole different kind of experience that I'm really looking forward to navigating in a way. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. Another thing that shapes me is London. Very much, I love London. Like, London is the soul of me. I love it. I also hate it at times. But to be precise, for me, London is encapsulated by pirate radio. I love the community adverts for hairdressers and fruit stores and, you know, really niche businesses. I love the idea of people scrambling on rooftops to put up aerials or take down aerials. I love mobile phone numbers being read out so people can ask for rewinds. Like, this whole culture, this whole tapestry of pirate radio is so alluring. I remember I used to have like an itchy trigger finger, but my trigger was a radio dial, and I knew that I could flick the radio dial with the exact amount of force to land between, for example, 96.9 and 99.3 and so on. And I don't know how I could do it because it was an analog dial, but I trained my brain and my ear so hard that pirate radio became a really important part of everything that I do. So it led me to MC culture.
I'm very happy for you, by the way. It didn't result in a side hustle of being an elite safe cracker. You're a frequency
not.
Cracker, a frequency cracker instead.
Well, that was an ambition at one point, and then probably a bit of a dead end career, to be fair, and especially when DAB came along. So MC culture kind of led me to drum and bass. I became a drum and bass MC for a number of years. That went really well. And then it took me to DJing, to putting on events. So it was kind of my entry point, but it also defined my music taste. UK garage, grime, reggae, dancehall, hip hop. And again, it all kind of feeds into this idea of these were music of other communities, but there was an identity for me that really made sense. As an outlier, it made sense that people were speaking of a struggle of race or a struggle of society in ways that I couldn't express or I didn't understand myself at the time. And so it also really, so London and Pirate Radio also really shapes how I read popular music or subcultures. You know, I can walk into a club or a festival and I can tell whether it's good or not. And I don't mean that in a subjective way. I mean that in a relatively objective sense of being able to read a room and be able to understand the space and what's going well and what's not going well. And I guess that's kind of led me to where I am now.
It sounds like that's an ability, acute ability to read an atmosphere in however one senses that.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like a bit of a spidey sense I have. And it's been trained. Like I used to go to gigs like 6 or 7 nights a week because I got time out. Remember when time out was like £2.60 and you'd have every single thing happening in London in this
yes.
weekly magazine. And I remember looking through the listings and, you know, they'll have really weird words to describe a particular gig. And I didn't know who they were, but I was fascinated by the words that would describe the gig. So I would go to the gig and I would just find this whole world of stuff. And so, yeah, I guess I've trained this superpower just through osmosis more than anything.
And an awareness of what's maverick, different, unusual, or distinctly different.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess Lyrics Organic started because I knew I wanted to do something different from what I was seeing. And there was a gap that I wasn't experiencing that I felt like I could create. So, yeah, that really kind of feeds into who I am. Mm-hmm. A third thing that shaped me was going to Sudan. I think it was 2015. I was doing some work at the mayor's office. I think it was Ken Livingstone at the time. Actually, it might even be Boris, but we did a show where we took over the whole of City Hall with a youth-led program. And one of the people I was working with, a guy called Dan Boyden, I'd never met before. We'd gotten really, really well in a short space of time, and he was putting in a proposal for British Council to do this thing in Sudan. Now, he does a lot of that kind of stuff. I'd never done anything like that overseas. And we knocked together a proposal, didn't really think anything of it, and then next thing we knew, we were on a plane to Sudan with two people who would become very good friends of mine, Deanna Roger, the poet, and a filmmaker called Fitzy. And we basically spent just over a week in Khartoum in Sudan working with 30 artists, artivists, we call them. So artists who are also activists from Ethiopia, Sudan, and South Sudan. And it was a really profound experience for all of the obvious reasons, but also because it kind of broke through a bit of a glass ceiling for me of what I thought I could achieve. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting there on the first day being like, I don't know why I'm here or how I'm going to navigate this. I was there fundamentally to coach Arabic speaking poets and theatre artists. And I don't speak Arabic. And I had this moment where I sat down in the first workshop. I was like, I'm going to have to blag this. And then I was like, no, I don't have to blag this. Actually, I am surrounded by really positive people. And let me really see if I can apply that idea of reading a room or reading spaces or reading people. So I studied psychology at university in a different language and be able to interpret their performances, not understand the language, but understand what they're saying.
Through the cadence, I'm imagining.
The cadence, their body language, the reaction of other people to those pieces as well. And it all culminated in this big production that we created, that we produced, that took place in a 6-star hotel which was owned by Colonel Gaddafi, weirdly. And it was quite, yeah, it was one of the most profound experiences of my life. I still carry it to this day. I still speak to a lot of the participants today. And it actually kind of opened the door to me doing loads of British Council projects in the space of 5 years. I went to Cuba, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Mexico, Russia, India, Georgia, all kinds of places, basically doing what I love, which is...
With the same squad each time or always different because you two got in with British Council?
Not with the same squad every time.
Yeah.
Often the ones that I've just mentioned, I would go on my own teaching events in emerging creative economies, which was really interesting. Like, how do you put on music events in a different paradigm, you know, a place which may have a dictatorship and you can't say certain things, or in Cuba where you can't always get all the equipment that you need, or in Ukraine where previously the dominant, well, one of the dominant languages was Russian, but depending on who you work with, so for example, if you work with younger people, they were more keen on using Ukrainian. If you work with older generation, they're more use Russian, and how you navigate those spaces. So yeah, it was different teams, different approaches.
So I'm hearing a bit of a people whisperer superpower in that you're reading environments differently and you're able to be the outlier, inlier, all very silky skills, actually, to be able to sort of move and navigate through quite a lot of distinct difference and differentiating environments.
Yeah, I think, yeah. I mean, this is probably the first time I've actually joined those dots in terms of being that person in the playground moving between different circles. And I think it, on a deeper level, there's probably something in finding validation originally. You know, who am I? Everyone looks different to me. Like, where do I fit in? But as time goes on, you know, I have such an interest in people. People are amazing. I fundamentally believe that all people are beautiful, even people who you dislike or people who you don't get on with or who are, you know, whatever. But somewhere deep inside them, there's a space where you can find common ground. Yes. And if you recognize that and you have the patience for it, you can kind of reach anybody. That's the idea. And then the fourth and final thing that shapes me is my 4-year-old son. Had a kid relatively late in the day, my late 30s, early 40s. And I guess the apart from how profound that was in an obvious way as a father, my dad passed away 10 days later and he never got to meet my son. So that gave me a lot of food for thought, as you can imagine. At the time, we were also on tour. So all of this was happening in the space of 2 weeks and my whole life was flipped upside down in a really positive way. I don't regret a thing. But it was really interesting. I've never had a massively close relationship with my parents. They didn't divorce or anything like that. A lot of families in my area, in my friendship group, divorced from early. So that was normal to me, but I was actually had a relatively stable upbringing. But by virtue of the second generation immigrant relationship with parents, it can either go really well or not so well. More time, it was not so well. Certainly from my kind of teens, unsurprisingly. And so when my dad passed away, along with the usual, I'm a new father, what does it mean to be a father? Like, oh my God, I've got to behave now and like model behavior. It then gave me a lot of cause for thought about how my dad modeled behavior and things that he did that I just didn't even think about at the time. And you don't until something profound happens. So, yeah.
And do you mind me asking, was it a bolt out of the blue or was your father unwell and therefore you were sort of standing by for it?
It was a bit of both. Like he had, was it kidney disease? So he was on catheters and stuff for a while, but he was... I was told that he was improving, but I think it was it wasn't COVID times, it was 2018, but they were told that they couldn't really have visitors, so we couldn't really visit. And in that intervening time, he took a quick downturn and then passed away pretty suddenly. So it was in the sights, but it was quite unexpected timing.
Yes.
So yeah, those are the four things that shape me. Three things that inspire me. I'm going to start with Ai Weiwei. Ai Weiwei, the visual artist, the Chinese dissident who's kind of exiled and at various points has lived in Deptford, actually, in Oxford, all around the world, in Greece and wherever his art calls, is someone who, you know, for me is the highest example of what it means to bring together art and activism. And actually, we can swap this out with anyone who is prepared to sacrifice their freedom or their comfort levels for a higher purpose for other people, typically. And that, I find this tremendously inspiring, not least because, you know, Lyrics Organics and I do quite a lot. People look to us and are like, oh my God, you're doing this amazing thing. Well done for supporting this. But truth is, it never feels like you're doing enough. And actually, the inspiration I find the people around me who are doing amazing activism stuff. It could be the people who were teaching in the workshops who would end up on the front line of the revolution in Khartoum in Sudan in 2017, who then went on to be part of the civilian government. It could be people in Hong Kong who are my brethren, but I don't actually know. It could be people I know who are on the front line protesting against this government's policing bill, which has a tremendous impact on our freedom of speech. But for me, Ai Weiwei is brave. He's quiet, which is unusual. He's fearless. And also the way that he thinks compassionately, but also abstractively. Is that a word? I don't know. I'll ask Toby. But in terms of the way he creates art that is influenced by such stuff and such experiences. I remember going to the Royal Academy to see his poles. I don't know how familiar you are with Ai Weiwei, but after an earthquake in China, he was like, this was his first major activism kind of project. And he was like, I need to go to this earthquake. I need to understand why all of these buildings, a little bit like what happened in Turkey, just collapsed. Like, no explanation, it shouldn't happen like that. Why did all these school children die? And anyway, he went there. He found that all of the supporting metal poles were not fit for purpose. He took all of them. He straightened them out, like hundreds, thousands of them. And then that became his artwork, which would sit in the middle of the Royal Academy. And just that thought process and that sensibility to turn something so graphic and painful into something that is so simple to understand and so artistic in its kind of presentation, it's incredibly inspiring.
And have you got a personal connection to him, or you just admire him from afar?
Just admired from afar, really. I mean, it's certainly amazing to see someone who has my skin colour doing that and being probably the best in the world at it. That's quite unusual. There's not many people who are lauded in the West of my skin tone up until the Oscars this year, where people put East and Southeast Asians on a pedestal. That's historically and culturally and racially, that doesn't happen. So the fact that Ai Weiwei cuts through all of that is tremendously inspiring. But no, there's no kind of personal kind of friendship there yet. Another thing that really inspires me is Glastonbury Festival, which is, I guess, slightly obvious. I'd been going to Glastonbury now for about 20, almost 25 years. I run a venue there called the Rumshack, which has now become quite infamous. It's a 1,000 capacity venue, which has had the likes of Kay Tempest and Mike Skinner, Akala, Koji Radical. It's a mix of DJs and live acts from all around the world. And it, you know, Glastonbury inspires me because, and this is so hard to communicate to people who haven't been to Glastonbury, it actually becomes a bit of a cliche, to be honest, until you get there. But there's an authenticity and a truth and a spirit and a heritage to Glastonbury that you won't find not only in any other festival, but in any other event, or indeed any other landmass anywhere else in the way that Glastonbury is. And it's hard to communicate this. You know, I teach event management to a lot of people, and frankly, because tickets are now £300 and it's so damn difficult to get tickets, people are like, I mean, why are you telling me about something I'm never going to go to? And I totally get it. And, you know, there's that danger of Glastonbury becoming increasingly elite for those reasons and other reasons. But ultimately, it still retains a truth which cannot, is just irreplaceable and indescribable. And so
it almost sounds like a pilgrimage as well in your sort of DNA, if you like.
Yeah, and it's a pilgrimage for many people, and it has been a pilgrimage for many people over centuries because of Glastonbury Tor, and
yes,
you know, supposedly the Holy Grail is buried close to there, and Stonehenge is close to there, and so there is, and all the ley lines in the southwest converge at Glastonbury. So there are genuine.
There's that brilliant book called Mists of Avalon as well, which you may have read.
I know of it, but I haven't read it, Sadie.
It's the Arthurian legend seen through women's eyes. It's fantastic, actually.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So having gone to Glastonbury for about 15 years, Lyrics Organics was doing, we decided when we started that we wanted to work with charities who we cared about, not just any charity. And long story short, we chose MSF, which is Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. They're Swiss originally, but they're a humanitarian aid organization that sent medical care to the front line of places that don't have medical care, and they'll be the first one in and the last one out. And long story short, we started doing a lot of work with them, and they got invited to Glastonbury, and this kind of evolved into a bigger venue with programming. Ed Sheeran played his first Glastonbury there. We had loads of amazing artists. Just as a bit of a tangent, it was quite interesting because in 2010, Haiti had that terrible earthquake and then the cholera epidemic and killed about a quarter million people or more. And my partner now, who was actually working at MSF at the time, Joe, she designed a venue based on her field trip to Haiti, which was like a crumbling wreckage of a hospital in Haiti, and it had a cholera tent inside. It had doctors and nurses and logisticians from the field to talk about their work. And it was, you know, it was, what's the word? It was pretty tough. It was a tough year. It was really rainy. You know, we were total newbies to it. But it eventually led to me running the Rumshack in 2013. And so I've never looked back since. So, yeah, that's been a tremendous influence to me.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
As a seminal event curation, yes.
Yeah, I think it culturally it's still, you know, it's kind of waning a little bit, if I'm honest, like for all kinds of reasons, but it still retains that magic. So
yes,
definitely an inspiration to me. And then the final one I'd say is actually, friends doing extraordinary things is probably the thing that most inspires me. And it sounds a little bit cheesy, but I don't really put people on pedestals. And that's kind of why, you know, we've worked with a lot of people who've gone on to become famous, because I don't really care about fame. Like,
yes,
to my own detriment, it's just not in my DNA. I'm not interested in egos whatsoever. So actually, you know, people like my friend Ben, who's got, you know, down in Margate, who got a startup brewery called Xylo, who's also, you know, has a kid with autism. That's inspiring. Like, yes. Deanna Roger, who I mentioned earlier, she's got two kids. She's a poet. She's had her poems read by Venus Williams. Excuse me.
Or both. They're twins.
I think it was Venus. But also, you know, people are just doing everyday things and getting through the end of the day and with their head held high and still doing their job and making a difference. Those are the people that really, mean a lot to me. You know, my grandma's lived in London for almost 40 years or 50 years, and she still can't speak English.
Is that your dad's mum?
Yeah, it's my dad's mum. She lives up in Harrow, and I'm amazed she still can't speak English. I mean, I still can't speak Chinese. I don't blame her. But the fact that she survived in this city for like all this time and just, you know, pretty much goes to the same supermarket, does the same thing, that's inspiring.
And what happens linguistically with times with Granny if she doesn't speak you?
Good question. It's pretty awkward, to be honest. Like, she speaks pidgin English. I can't even speak pidgin Chinese. It's difficult. It's difficult. And it's a source of frustration for me. We're thinking about teaching my kid at the moment Chinese, but there's not really any Cantonese school. He's technically Cantonese. Cantonese is a dying language. You know, it's a similar thing to Ukrainian. You have to fight for it. Like, it represents, it represents far more than the words. And, you know, in China, they're pretty much eradicating Cantonese out of the education system. But Mandarin is arguably far more useful and far more, you know, there's more Mandarin schools in the UK. So, yeah, it's difficult. And it's, the irony is, having spent so much time, and maybe it's because I spend so much time in the language of music, and the language of performance, that I try and make up for my deficiencies in Chinese.
Yes. And now we're up to the two squirrels of distraction. What never fails to... Well, squirrels, and here is a squirrel for you. You're welcome, no extra charge. That always never fail to grab your attention, irrespective of anything else that's going on for you.
Sneakers. I can be really superficial sometimes. And I just love trainers. I'm a hip-hop kid by root. And I'm always like... You know, when you judge people in the first 8 seconds, like, I'm not looking at their face, I'm not looking at their clothes, I'm looking at their shoes. Like, my default kind of resting position is down, looking at people's shoes, because you can tell so much about them, like people's culture, people's identity, even to the point of not wanting to make people feel insecure about their shoes, because it really doesn't matter. But, you know, depending on how worn in a particular type of shoe is,
yes,
I can read quite a lot into that person. I think I can, anyway. I might be totally wrong.
So you're not after the sort of daily crisp unboxed new pair. You're more about the sort of the history of the wearing that you're interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, even then, like, a box fresh pair says a lot about someone, but you can read more by, you know, a shoe that's got like a bit of a chip on the side or a broken heel or like a really, you know, I have a lot of, shoes that collectors would go wild over, but I've worn them to death and people would be like, I can't believe you've done that to that shoe. Do you know that shoe's now worth like a grand now? I'm like, I don't want to collect shoes. I want to wear the shoes.
And you'll be familiar with do you remember the Brian Keenan book, If I Lose My Shoes, I'll Never Get Out of Here? Which was a hostage escape device. Whatever I do, I mustn't lose my shoes, because that was the way of escaping. So stories that shoes tell, I get it completely.
But he didn't have to escape in the end, did he? He got freed, is that right?
Yes, but what kept him going was keeping an eye on his shoes, because, I mean, that's what's so extraordinary. I mean, it just became something symbolic for his survival.
That's really interesting. I never thought of sneakers in terms of, you know, this is a very, very Western privilege thing to say. You know, sneakers is very much, not Western actually. It's increasingly Eastern culture as well. But it's a wealth, you know, thing. You know, you have to be able to afford shoes. And actually, you know,
just in the news in the last 2 days, there was the most money ever spent on the Jordan sneakers. If you know the trainers,
How much was it?
Well, now I'm going to catch myself out. It's something loony, like 40. I'm going to say 40 million, but that might be too much. But it's an insane amount for shoes that have been worn and are probably a bit smelly. But who knows?
Actually, now that you say it, in answer to your question that you asked later about things I told myself younger, I wish I'd collected sneakers from young. Then I wouldn't even need a job right now. Do you know what I mean?
And forgive me, I'm going down a bit of my own rabbit hole. I use a bell to go, cashier number four, please, to get me. I went down a rabbit hole there. I'm sorry. So you've got squirrel now.
So the second squirrel is derelict buildings.
Ooh.
They hypnotize me. Like, as soon as I see one, that's it. Everything stops. I don't care if I'm on the way to a meeting, like if I'm in the middle of a conversation, I have to go to that building. And not often, because like that building will be kind of embellished with street art, or at least have, you know, perhaps history of squatting, or like all of these kind of subcultures and countercultures and communities that converge on disused spaces. So yeah, I think there's so much to kind of marvel at. I went to Lisbon last year with some of my boys, and I did a street art tour because Lisbon's a bit of a mecca.
I love that, by the way. Some of my boys, that is your crew, by the sound of it. Your squad are called your boys.
Yeah, it was a real little squad out in. And so I was like, guys, I need to go on a street art tour. So I left all of them and I was like, listen, if you want to come, you're going to have an amazing time, but this is what I'm going to do. Come with me. My best mate came with me. And we went to see this piece by Blue and Oz Gimios, who I think is a Brazilian muralist. And it was stunning. It was like this huge derelict building, bricktop windows, and it was like a corner building. So it was like three or four stories, and all of it was wraparound street art. And it was amazing, incredible. And then when I walked around the back, it was just a facade, because the whole building behind it had been hollowed out, but you could still see like the kitchen shelves, the toilet, the wallpaper, and yet there was like trees growing out of it and animals through it. And, you know, there's something about this idea of stories and hidden stories and
in the fabric of a building. Yes, I love that.
Yeah, and the construct of it. Yeah, so that's my second school.
And now, a quirky or unusual fact about you, Dan Tzu, we couldn't possibly know until you tell us.
I almost died in Ethiopia.
Ooh.
I like getting myself into a bit of scrapes, like going on missions, on walks particularly. And I thought I would die in Ethiopia. I went to Lalibela in the north to go see, it's a UNESCO heritage site where they have loads of rock-hewn churches, so churches that are carved out of the rock, and some of them might be two or three stories high. And it was off-season, and I was staying in this hotel. I was the only one staying in this hotel. It was a really modest place, and they were really lovely, probably because I was the only like tourist in the village, basically. And I asked them to make me a little packed lunch so I could go for this walk, and bless them, they made me like this Pyrex glass bowl, like a big one, of spaghetti bolognese. And I was like, that's really impractical for me going up this mountain. We were already like 2,000 feet up, and then it was about another, I don't know, whatever, 1,000 or 1,500, and I was like, okay, thanks, I'm definitely gonna eat it, but
have spag bowl will travel. I love that.
So I mean, this is a much longer story, but essentially I started walking and I started picking up friends. And one friend was like a 7-year-old boy who wouldn't, you know, leave me. But we got on really well. And the subtext is that they want money, but this particular 7-year-old just wanted to hang out. And then this other 12-year-old joined, and he did want money, and he was on the hustle, and I couldn't really lose him. And I basically had this pair, you know, we went through these kind of like aloe vera areas and these kind of eucalyptus forests, and eventually there was like this a church in a cave, but you had to pay to get into this cave. And I was like, I can't be paying, and it's like something like $20 in northern Ethiopia. It was so expensive, and I was like, I can't, I've already seen 24 of these churches, I'm just not that into it. I'm not religious. I love churches as architectural buildings, but anyway. But I found out that there was like another route to the top of the mountain. There's stairs going through the church to the top, or you could walk around. And the kids were like, let's go around. It's fine, it's fine, it's fine. Anyway, I was like, are you sure? Maybe I should just pay these $20. I'll pay for you guys, it's fine. And then I was like, no, let's do it. Let's trust the kids. Like, it's theirs. They know this place. And we started climbing up this thing, and it became like this sheer vertical cliff face. And these guys were bounding up like, you know, gazelle. And I was on there, and I was looking down, and I was like, I'm in serious ish right now. Like, no one knows that I'm here. I can't climb. I've got a glass bowl of spaghetti bolognese weighing me down. And I'm not a climber. I'm not sure I'm going to make it. I can, you know, I'm getting vertigo. The whole thing was freaking me out. It's either the only way is up, basically. Eventually,
cue the music. Faced my
fears, got up, climbed the rock face. But there was a moment where I thought I would die in Ethiopia, and that's what I said to myself. But then it ended happily. When I got to the top, I had what I thought was my last cigarette. I shared the spaghetti bolognese with the two boys, so we were all eating with our hands out of this Pyrex dish. And then I was listening to my favorite reggae artist, Buju Banton, at the top of this mountain, which was probably cumulatively about 3,000 meters up. It was feet, meters, I can't remember. But anyway, it was
what an iconic day. I'm sure the two kids have never forgotten that day either. The sort of lunacy of eating spag bol from a Pyrex dish 3,000 meters up, all that. It's all great.
Probably never even seen a Chinese guy either. So it was, the whole thing was just a bit bonkers.
No wonder they wanted to hang out. This isn't going to happen again. Great story, yeah. By the way. I wasn't sure whether it was the people that you picked up that were going to be the peril or the actual epic quest that was the peril, but it was actually the vertigo that nearly killed you.
Yeah, quite. I mean, I'm not great. I'm not bad on heights, but this was, yeah, I could see very, very far and very, very down.
And now we've shaken your tree. Huzzah. Now we're going to stay in the clearing, move away from the tree, and we're talking about alchemy and gold now. When you're at purpose and in flow, Dan Sue, what are you absolutely happiest doing in what you're here to reveal to the world?
Yeah, thanks for asking this question. I really enjoyed thinking about it. I mean, I guess I never really considered what a flow state was until I saw Michael Jordan. So it's interesting you brought up Jordans earlier. Like, Michael Jordan was a hero to me, and really shaped what I thought humans could achieve. He's, you know, very superhuman. The idea that a person could fly. And at various points, I would have said, for me, my kind of flow state was MCing, rapping, like that feeling when you're in the pocket where you're nailing all of the beats and all the half beats, and you hit the drop and sometimes you change your cadence or you change your flow because you know that lyric so well that suddenly you're adapting it to the beat, so you're essentially creating a song but live. And that there's a real energy and a feeling to that I miss. I love being in the pocket, and because I would MC double time, so, you know, what, extra quick, because I was MCing over drum and bass. When you hit the pocket, it feels like you are, you know, driving a Formula One car and hitting all the corners. Like, it's just amazing. And then eventually, like, that would turn into DJing. Like, when you're in the mix and you've got the perfect two tracks together and you've got this crowd who are loving what you're doing and they're waiting for your next mix, and you know that this mix is going to kill it, but only you know what's going to happen next when it drops, and you have the control over, you know, 1,000 people and their experience at that moment. That is an amazing flow state.
And as we leave Dan Sue in the pocket, nailing the beats and the half beats, hitting the drop, that rather sadly brings us to the end of time here on today's episode here on UK Health Radio. But pop along to Buzzsprout. You can listen to the entire end of the episode now. And you can also listen to the full podcast version on the UK Health Radio podcast as well. So sorry to tease you. Leave it hanging as we hit the drop. Join in next week for more stories from the clearing when we'll be back in the pocket. Thank you very much indeed. Good night. You've been listening to The Good Listening To show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
If you- you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from The Clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@thatchrisgrimes.
So until next time, for me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
And goodbye.